You're listening to Profiles in France Formation, the podcast where we hear from inspiring people who have pursued their dream of moving to France. We learn about why they moved, how they overcame the challenges they faced, and what they love and hate about living in France. I hope that hearing their stories can help you to pursue your dreams and maybe your very own France Formation. I'm your host, Allison Grant Luness, and I'm here to tell you, my guests followed their dreams, and you can follow yours too. It starts today. Welcome to episode 39 of Profiles in France Formation. I'm your host, Allison Grant Luness, and in today's episode, we're speaking with Steve Wilkeson and his wife, Carol Richmond. Originally from Southern California, Steve first became enchanted with France when he backpacked throughout Europe at the age of 18, and it took him 12 years of marriage to talk Carol into moving to Vence. Carol Richmond grew up in Minneapolis and Austin, and despite feeling ambivalent about moving to France in the first place, she has enjoyed exploring and developing a thriving social life in Vence. Steve is a web designer, writer, and photographer, and he writes about his adventures and discoveries on their website, Steve and Carol in Vence. Welcome, Steve and Carol.
So can you guys start by introducing yourselves and telling me what inspired you to move to France? How did you end up here?
Sure. I'll start. My name is Steve Wilkeson. I'm here with my wife, Carol Richmond. I first came to France when I was 18. And I stayed about 3 months. I had quit college and I was just kind of backpacking around Europe a little bit and ended up spending most of my time in France and really kind of got under my skin, so to speak. I went back to the US and I didn't really have an opportunity to come back to France for about 20 years. But then in the early 90s, I started coming here on a regular basis, sometimes for business and sometimes for pleasure. And I decided that I wanted to move to France someday. So I met Carol, I think 1994, met Carol in 1994. And one of the first things I told her was that, you know, someday I think I would like to move to France. She wasn't too sure about the idea, but she figured, well, that's a long ways away. She told me that she was very close to her mother. We lived in Nashville. Her mother lived in Minneapolis, and she didn't want to think about moving that far away from her mom, which I completely understood. So I just figured, you know, okay, well, sooner or later, we'll talk about this again at some point. I started coming over to France twice a year at some point. I was teaching at a college in Nashville, Tennessee, so I had my summers off. So that gave me a perfect opportunity to come for a little vacation in France. Carol worked retail, so it was much harder for her to get very much time off. Maybe 1 or 2 weeks a year was all she could get off for vacation time. She would come with me occasionally, but sometimes I came over by myself. Sometimes I came with friends. I'm a big cyclist, and so I would always bring my bike, and we'd do cycling adventures, my friends and I, throughout France. And so every year I would kind of come over, started for about 2 or 3 weeks. And then gradually I started coming for a little bit longer. And at some point I said to Carol, I said, so listen, how long do you think I could go for a vacation by myself in the summer without you divorcing me while I was gone? And we finally settled on about 2 months was about the limit that she was going to be happy with. So, and even that was kind of stretching it a bit.
Well, we had pets too, so there was other responsibilities.
Yeah. So I would come over, and when I first started coming over with some friends, like I said, we were doing some cycling adventures. We would go to the Alps for a week, where there's lots of great cycling in the Alps. I'd always loved Nice. I'd come to Nice the first time I was here back in the 70s. So we come to Nice for a week, and then we go to Paris for a week. And kind of did that for several years. And 1 year when I was in Nice, I was looking at different places to cycle around. Some people say I'm obsessed with small French villages. I just love the little villages, especially the ones up in the mountains and in this area down here near Nice. So I would get on my bike and I'd cycle up to some of these villages. And I passed through the town called Vence one day. And I stopped for some lunch when I was there and rode around on my bike a little bit in Vence. And I was like, wow, this is the perfect town. It's not too big. It's not too small. It's only about 15 kilometers from Nice and Antibes. It's very close to the coast, but we're also very close to the mountains. And I was like, you know, I think someday this is where I'd like to live. So after that, instead of going to Nice every year, I found a place to rent in Vence, and I would come to Vence every year. And as soon as I stayed here for any amount of time, I knew, yep, this is the place that I want to live. You know, I always tell people, people ask me, you know, it's not an accident that we live in Vence. It's not like we just ended up here by happenstance or something. I knew very specifically, this is where I want to move to in France. So I continued to do that for several years. And then I have some friends that live in Paris. And one year at Christmas, they emailed me and said, hey, listen, we're going to go to New York for a couple of weeks at Christmas time. If you want, you can come and house sit our apartment in Paris. So I was like, you know, I was already going for 2 months during the summer. And I was like, hey, sweetie, you think it'd be okay if I went to Paris for a couple of weeks in December? And she said, okay. So, but that kind of opened up the door that then after that, I would come for 2 months during the summer, and I would come for two or three or eventually 4 weeks in December, I would come to Vence. So that happened for several years. And I guess in 2018, Carol's mother died. And I waited. I figured I had to be pretty respectful about this. I couldn't just, you know, the next week say, hey, your mom's gone now. You're ready to move to France.
So, yeah, probably not.
So I waited a whole year. And then I finally broached the subject with her and said, hey, you know, we've always talked about maybe moving to France someday. What do you think? And I think she was a bit surprised. She wasn't really expecting to have this conversation. You can tell her a little bit.
Yes, I was in denial and resistance all along the way. Either he would change his mind or I would change my mind at some point during these years, but neither one of those things happened.
Yeah, well, it's the kind of thing when it seems so far off, you think it might like fizzle out.
Yeah, then... or I'll change my mind and get excited about it, but yeah.
Yeah. So you were ambivalent then about the idea of moving to France someday?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't anything against France. Life France was fine, but I liked my life in the U.S.
Yeah. So how did that conversation go, Carol? And what sort of brought you around to, oh, this is going to happen? Yeah. And how did you feel during the process of getting ready to move?
Well, so I went into this conversation still thinking I'm not doing this. And, but during the conversation, I'm remembering whatever, that how much Steve has wanted to do this and for so long, and he's such a good guy. And also my happy place that I've felt at home completely from the beginning was Austin, Texas. And I got to live there for 20 some years. So I thought, you know, maybe Steve should be able to live in his so-called happy place. So I said, well, just look into what's involved in moving. Well, literally 24 hours later, we had a realtor at the house. He was taking no chances on me changing my mind.
Get you out of there. Get you on that plane before you can. Yeah.
And that's pretty much what happened, because within 4 months, our entire lives had ended.
Yeah. So, you know, she said, yeah, okay, go ahead and look into it. And I had a friend that's a real estate agent. So I just called her up and said, hey, you know, we're thinking about maybe moving to France. What would be involved in selling our house? And what do you think we could get for it? And so she came out and we talked to her for a little bit. And like I said, I was teaching college at the time and my contract was up in May. So I told Carol, I said, well, this would be the perfect time for us to move, would be at the end of May when my contract is up.
Actually, what happened was she asked when we wanted the house sold by. And you said, well, at the end of the semester, because I'm thinking, you know, 6 months, a year, you know. And he's saying, no, in like 3 months.
He's already got the suitcases packed.
Yeah, so we ended up, and looking back in retrospect, I will even admit myself that we did this pretty quickly. From the day we had this conversation to the day we were on the plane was just under 4 months. So we literally sold our house, sold everything that we had, packed up what we were going to bring with us.
Quit our jobs.
Quit both our jobs, bought an apartment here in Vence, and moved here in 4 months, which was really very fast.
Wow. But that's kind of like what can happen when you've been building up something or you've been creating it in your mind for months or for years. Like once you make that decision, everything can happen so quickly.
Yeah. And that was it. I'm a very kind of, you know, goal oriented type person. I was like, okay, we're going to do this. Let's do it. You know, okay, we'll do this. We need to do this. We need to do this. We'll get it all done. And we got it all done. And we arrived here May 30th in 2019. So we've been here about 3 years and 3 months at this point. But we got, you know, we had a few things I feel like just kind of got lucky and fell into place for us because I was teaching college at the time. You know, we had this conversation around the end of January, and I had a 1 week spring break in March. And so I told Carol, I said, hey, why don't we take this 1 week in March, fly over to Vaughn's and talk to a real estate agent over there and look around and see if we find anything that we want to buy. And sure enough, you know, we found a great real estate agent and she showed us maybe 16, 17 properties in the 5 days that we were here. And one of the last properties that we looked at, we really liked and we put down an offer and it was accepted and, you know, everything just kind of fell into place.
Wow. Yeah, it's really amazing how everything can work out so smoothly when.
Well, there were a few bumps.
Yeah, there were a few bumps along the way. And it was
our house, it depended on us selling our house in the U.S. And there were some glitches there. You know, we had an offer fall through right after we put in our promise to buy here. And it was like, oh, great.
Yeah.
But we didn't.
I just had that happen to a client last week. She had an offer in her house. It was supposed to close. We put her visa start date as that date. And then driving home from the visa appointment, she got a call. Oh, the offer fell through. So they're back on the market. But
and so we were kind of an interesting situation because we're both Americans, but I was actually born in London. My father was in the American military and he was stationed in London with my mom. So I have dual citizenship, both American and British. So for many years, when I was thinking about moving here, I was always like, oh, this is going to be super easy. You know, Britain is part of the EU. We don't have to do no papers. It'll be super easy. We can just move to France. I can work there if I want. And then, of course, Brexit came up, started a couple of years before we moved here. So at the time that we were deciding to move here, Brexit was still hadn't been decided. It had been voted, yes, they were going to leave, but they hadn't worked out all the details. So we didn't know how that would affect us. So we decided the first year just to go ahead and get visas that Americans get. You know, we got a 1 year visa that could be continued or extended after the first year was up. So, you know, we went down to Atlanta, went through the whole visa process, got our visas. That went pretty smoothly. We got all those and we came here. After the first year that we were here, when our visas were getting ready to expire, we had to renew them. I talked to an immigration lawyer. Brexit still hadn't been completely resolved, but I talked to an immigration lawyer and she said, you know, you'd be much better off living here as British citizens than Americans. You'll have more rights. You'll get just a lot more benefits. She said, so just let your visa expire. You have a British passport. So right now you can live in France without a problem. And then when Brexit, I'm sure you probably know all of this, you know, when Brexit was finally finalized, they put into place this thing called the WARP agreement, the withdrawal agreement residency permit. And so as British citizens, well, and her being my wife, that had been living here before Brexit, we were able to apply for that. And we got 5-year residency cards through the British system, which, yeah, is much better than the American visas.
Yeah. And for a while, we had a couple of British clients back around that time who were trying to get in under the wire with Brexit. And we weren't really sure, like, is it better to come on, you know, a retired visa, a visitor visa as Americans, because then you bypass the whole, you know, at the time it was kind of a mess, like British people were applying for carte de séjour, but they couldn't, a lot of prefectures weren't issuing them yet because there wasn't an agreement.
Right. Yeah.
So my thinking at the time was, let's get you in an American visa so that it can just be renewed. And then you are not involved in the whole Brexit mess when they have to suddenly process hundreds of thousands of British citizens living in France within a couple of months. But it did turn out to be better for people to file under that withdrawal agreement.
Yeah. So it worked out great for us because, you know, like I said, the first year we were here on an American 1-year visa. And then after that, we got the British one, and now we're set for 5 years, and we can renew it after the 5 years. We can get a 10-year card the second time around. So we're pretty happy with how all that worked out. It was a little stressful here and there because, like you said, you know, we didn't know exactly what was going to happen and everything. But the process of getting the carte de séjour through the British citizenship was fairly easy. We went online and applied, and then we got an appointment once it was all settled and went down to the prefecture in Nice and took fingerprints and all that stuff. And then we got our cards a month or two later.
So what were some of the challenges then when you first started arriving and you started getting set up here? What were some of the things that maybe you didn't expect and you weren't used to, even though you had been visiting?
I'll let Carol answer that. See, Carol will tell you, it's like, nothing really bothers me too much because I am so happy.
He's in heaven.
I'm so happy to be living in France. It's like, all right, whatever. Okay, sure. No problem. Okay, whatever. So she's a lot more affected by some of this stuff than I am.
Yeah. The first year was very difficult for me. I mean, most, you know, a lot of people, when I tell them that we're moving to France, they think, oh, what a romantic adventure. Well, it is that, but you know, moving to a foreign country is a whole lot more than that, especially like from the US to here, the whole metric system, everything's different. And, you know, so many differences in the culture. And then not only that, but we moved into our apartment in August, which is, of course, is the worst month of the year to try and do that. And we were staying and moving around in Airbnbs for several months before that, waiting to close. And so I'm somebody that I need a home. And so moving around is not very easy for me, I guess. And we were sleeping on air mattresses for 5 weeks because nobody would deliver anything in August. And you know, all these things, it's like, wait a minute, I didn't plan on doing this when I retired. This is, I feel like I'm back in college or something.
Yeah, we were going around trying to buy furniture for our apartment. Like she said, we closed at the beginning of August. And everybody was like, oh yeah, sure, we can get you a bed, we can deliver it in November. And we're like, November? You know, so, you know, we finally found we couldn't even get a couch or anything, you know, and so it was difficult. And then when we ordered stuff and when it was finally okay in September, whatever, when it was going to be delivered, we went through a lot of the somewhat typical delivery stuff with the French system, you know, our couch in specific. We bought it, had a scheduled delivery date. They called me up. She was very happy. Oh, we're going to have a couch. Have some place to sit. You know, they called me up that morning and said, oh, sorry, we were trying to deliver your couch, but your street's too narrow for our truck. So we're going to have to try again next week.
Except for somebody else had delivered a refrigerator that day. So anyway.
So then the next week they call back and say, oh, sorry, we were going to deliver your couch today, but it was raining, so we couldn't really deliver it. I'm like, okay. So then the next week, oh, sorry, we were going to deliver your couch today, but the truck broke down, so they won't be able to deliver it today. So it took 4 delivery days before we ever actually got our couch. And all the time, this is driving her just absolutely crazy.
Yes, I had numerous meltdowns the first year, and there were murder threats, but I'm still here and Steve's still alive. So,
murder is frowned upon in France.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. But yeah, I wouldn't get the insurance either if I killed him. So, you know, it was just not going to be, it wasn't a good plan. So,
yeah.
But anyway, yeah, the first year was the most difficult for me. And I'm a night person. I mean, literally a night person where I'm up all night. Well, living down here, things close at 7 o'clock.
Yeah.
So it's not a culture that's really compatible with my schedule at all.
Yeah, you know, in the U.S., the grocery stores, almost all of them are open 24 hours. So she could go shopping at 2-3 in the morning if she wanted to.
Which I did.
And she can't do that kind of stuff around here.
So, yeah, the first year was difficult for me. But luckily, we already had a good social system. We already knew quite a few people, and through everybody would meet more people. And it just, you know, our social group, because that was my big fear of moving here, was being isolated. Because I also didn't know the language because I was resisting moving here. I wasn't studying like Steve was. And so that's been a big barrier for me, a big obstacle, is not knowing the language. Although I can definitely get along without it, but not nearly as well. So it's been a big lesson in letting go for me, letting go of the past and letting go of having any control over what's happening right now. It's like, I don't have a clue. I'm just hoping this will turn out okay. Because I don't know what they said. I don't know when they said they were going to do this. Or I don't know what this message means that they left on the phone.
Yeah. And I mean, especially in August, like you said, I mean, you can't get anything done with anybody. So tell me about how you started making friends. Do you have friends from your travels? Are your friends mostly French, British, American, kind of a mix? Tell us about how you started integrating into the community, developed a social life, things like that.
Well, I was coming over here the most. Like I said, you know, I was coming over for about 3 months of the year. And Carol usually would come over for a week or two, or sometimes some years, not even that much. So at first, I was mostly making friends, English-speaking friends that I would meet around town or whatever. The turning point for me was there's an organization in France called the AVF, which is in, I think there's 300 or 400 chapters all over the country. And, you know, it's kind of like a welcoming organization that is specifically designed to help people, French people that move from one town to another in France, or also people that move from another country to France. And they have all kinds of activities, you know, they have language activities and hiking activities and pétanque activities and painting activities and go on outings. So I joined, somebody told me about this, and I joined the AVF, and I like to do a lot of hiking. So I started going on hiking trips. And that was really kind of opened up the floodgates, because it was mostly all French people. And I met just so many French people when I would go on these weekly hikes with them. And they were very nice and very welcoming. And that's how I started making French friends here in Vence. And it really does make a difference. You know, if you're going to live here, you have to become part of the community and get to know the French people that live here. Occasionally, I run into people in Vence and other places down here on the Côte d'Azur that have lived here for a long time and just kind of stay in their own little expat circle, you know, and never really mix with the French people. But that's not why I want to live in France. I want to live in France because it's France. So I want to meet French people and learn about the culture and get to know stuff. So that's been very helpful in us getting to know people.
And yeah, it's been very helpful too. And whenever we've needed to find a doctor, to find a plumber, whatever it is, you know, they've been very helpful in referring us to people.
Yeah, it's all about connection, especially in those small villages.
Yeah. Yeah. And we have more friends, you know, we have more friends and a bigger social life here than we ever had in the United States, you know.
And part of that's that I'm not working, so I have the time.
Yeah.
Because
right.
I have a lot of friends in the U.S. too, but still, it was very surprising to me, because my big fear was being isolated, that not at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was one thing that was important to me when we moved here. You know, Vence is, like I said, it's not too big, it's not too small. It's probably, I think, around 18,000-19,000 people. So, you know, everything you need is here, located in the center of the town. You know, there's several grocery stores, there's lots of pharmacies, there's boulangeries, everything you need is here. And I really wanted to live in town. You know, we live right on the edge of the old town here, so that we could just walk out the door. You know, it takes us 2 minutes to go to just anywhere, to go grocery shopping, to go to the bank, to go to restaurants. Anything we want to do is within walking distance. I'd read and heard a lot of stories about people over the years that had this kind of idyllic dream of living in the French countryside. And then they would get out there and they would just be so isolated that they were unhappy, because it's like, oh, well, we're out in the middle of nowhere. And yes, it's beautiful, but we don't know anybody and there's no neighbors. So I wanted, because I knew it was going to be difficult for her, I wanted to make sure we were in town where it would be easy to meet people and see people and do things together and mix. You know, we can walk out our door, I swear, even though there's 20,000 people almost living here, walk out our door and walk down the street, and we almost always run into somebody that we know, which is really nice.
Yeah. Yeah. Carol, what do you like particularly about living there? What are some of your favorite things? What are some of your favorite things? What do you appreciate, even if you're still mitigé?
Well, a lot of things are, there's pros and cons to the same thing, because it is really nice to be able to walk to everything, even our friends. So many of them live close by. But on the other hand, I am used to more space. I've never lived in an apartment before. So we opted to choose a different lifestyle. Even if we were living in the U.S., this would be a different lifestyle. And because we had an acre with woods in the back and wildlife, and I was a big gardener. So this is a big, major change for me. But on the other hand, I do really like being able to walk to the doctor down the block, and there's a little movie theater, and just having a perros with friends all the time. And so I really do like that. And of course, the patisseries, you can't ignore the patisseries. So, because I have a big sweet tooth. So we don't drink wine. So there are those that think France is wasted on us. But I think I make up for it in the patisseries.
Fair enough. Yeah. What about cheese? That can get you credit.
About what?
Cheese.
Oh, yes. I love the cheese. I love the dairy products. All the dairy products.
Oh, yeah.
So much more flavorful than the ones in the U.S. I don't know if they're less pasteurized or what it is, but not less processed. But yeah, they taste so much better.
If you want to move to France but aren't sure how to make it happen, the place to start is with the visa. Knowing your French visa options can help you to develop your vision of what your future transformation will look like and enable you to take concrete steps towards pursuing your dream of living in France. That's why I've written Foolproof French Visas, the complete guide to understanding and applying for French visas. It lays out all of the requirements for each of the 22 French long-stay visa types, from short-term work visas to family visas to the passport talent, from how to apply to pathways to permanent residency and naturalization. Foolproof French Visas is available in paperback on Amazon and as an ebook on yourfrancetransformation.com/books.
So tell me about, like, what does a typical week look like for you? What are the kinds of things that you're doing and spending your time?
Me, it's mostly socializing, although it took me 2 years, but I am now taking a French class. It's a very beginner's one. And I have to honestly say, I don't try that hard but some of it's seeping into this old brain. And then I was doing, of course, you know, what, 6 months, 7 months after we moved into our apartment, COVID hit. So we went into lockdowns. So from that, I started a Pilates Zoom class with a woman that we've met here. And so that's one day a week. Again, my schedule is weird because I don't get up until 2 p.m. I do literally sleep during the day.
So you're resisting to adjusting to the time zone then?
Oh, I thought I would. I've always been like this. And I thought maybe I would be able to do that moving here. But no, slowly my body just went back to the same thing. It doesn't.
She's just always been that way. She goes to bed at dawn and gets up at 2 or 3 p.m.
It does not change, even though it's not always convenient. That's just me. But, and then we have a friend that had a stroke. And so one day I go over and play cards with her. And there are many parties, and there's a party Saturday night, or there's dinners, and there's lots of dinners and aperos and stuff with friends. And we go hiking occasionally, although I haven't been lately so much. We take little trips around France because Steve wants to see everything France. I can't get him to cross the border into another country until he's seen every inch of France. We also adopted a rescue dog this year, and she's very time consuming because she's not quite what I had envisioned. So I guess that's my typical day. I don't know.
Yeah, I especially during some of the lockdown periods when we were stuck here a lot, and we could only go a certain distance from our house and stuff, I would try to schedule 2 or 3 little activities every week for us. You know, we'll go visit a village that's 20 miles, 20 kilometers away, or we'll go on a little hike down at the river, things like that. But, and we still do that. And like Carol said, you know, we have lots of friends that we will go on little weekend trips with and see various parts of France, you know, that's not too far away. And I do a lot of cycling. I still do a lot of cycling. So 2 or 3 days a week, I go cycling sometime during the day and go on hikes with the ABF sometimes. But I love Vence so much. I try to chronicle all of the stuff that goes on in Vence, you know, and there's just so many festivals and so many commemorations and everything. There's always something going on that I try to go down and take videos and take pictures and write about it for our website on those things.
That's true. Last night, there was just vertical dancing on one of the old chateau towers. You know, there's always something happening in Vence, even though it's a fairly small town. It's just surprising to me.
Yeah, those villages can be pretty lively, even if they're small.
Yeah.
And Vence is actually a functioning town all year round. It's not dependent on the tourist season.
Yeah, because I know it's popular with tourists, but I was wondering about whether the population changes at all. But it sounds like it doesn't.
Not too much, you know.
No, the summer. Are you kidding? The summer is way more busy than the rest of
the year. I'm sure it's more crowded, yeah. But
still, during the rest of the year, it's still, you know, it's a functioning town. You know, some of the little villages around here that are popular with tourists kind of shut down and are just dead during the winter. But this is a working town, so there's always stuff going on.
And we have friends that come and go from other countries. They do the 90-day thing, or maybe they're in Europe and they don't have to do that. But, you know, they spend part of their time here and part of the time wherever else they live. And so we always seem to have friends coming and going.
Yeah.
It keeps us pretty busy.
Sounds like.
Yeah.
So what are some of your favorite places to go hiking and cycling and to visit, whether around you or anywhere in France? What do you recommend?
Well, so Vence is in the Alpes Maritime department. A quick little story. When I first started coming here, I got this book that had like 78, I think, villages in the Alpes Maritime department. And so I set this goal for myself that I would visit all of these villages on my bike and cycle around to all of them. And so that took me a couple of years, you know, of doing cycling here and there and visiting all the different villages. But the thing about Vence is that we're very close to the ocean and we're also very close to the mountains. So I can go cycling down on the coast or I can go cycling up in the mountains. There's a lot of stuff you can do from right here in Vence, or I can just throw my bike in the back of the car and drive an hour or two and be up in the real mountains and do some cycling up there. So it's a really, for me, it's a cycling paradise down here. And the same thing with hiking. You know, this group with the AVF that I go hiking with sometimes, they're very serious. We're not talking about little afternoon strolls. They usually leave about 7 or 8 in the morning and we get back at 4 or 5 in the afternoon. And they drive up a couple hours into the mountains and then do a 5-hour hike in the mountains and then drive back to Vence. So there's just so much to do around this area.
Yeah, it sounds like a really great place for somebody who wants to be active and enjoy nature.
Yeah.
It's nice to be near everything.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, there's tons of other places in France that I love, but this is kind of the place where I feel the most at home. Last year, we took a 10-day vacation trip and went up to Normandy. And we had a wonderful time up at Normandy exploring all of that stuff. We went right around D-Day. So we were there for all the D-Day celebrations. And Carol can tell you her dad.
Oh, well, yeah, I did some research beforehand and because I knew my dad had been there shortly after the initial invasion. And it was like the next week or so that he landed. And he was stationed there apparently in an apple orchard for 2 months through the summer. And it was the first airfield. I think it was the first airfield on French territory or France soil from the US. And so it was very interesting. And there was so much to do up there. And then because I had a personal connection. And then we've met so many French people that have, you know, were from that area. And they have family stories about World War II, which is very interesting. Like one woman the paratroopers landed and her grandmother's property while they were there. And just, yeah, very interesting because, you know, we didn't have the war on our soil. The French had it right in their backyard.
Yeah, we were up there in April and we went to all those places. So we were at Sainte-Mère-l'Église. We went to Omaha Beach and Utah Beach, which I had never been to before.
Wasn't Omaha Beach beautiful? It was just,
it's so windy though. So windy, yeah.
I just thought it was all so peaceful, you know, thinking about what had happened there, you know, and it all was so peaceful now. But we found the monument to the airstrip that where my dad had been, and it was out in the middle of wheat fields, and it was like so green.
Yeah, my son is really into the airplanes, so we did a lot of looking at the World War II airplanes and the airstrikes and stuff. That was kind of the beginning of It coincided with the beginning of being interested in all of that stuff. And it was really amazing because it was the very beginning of well, not the beginning of, they did use airplanes in World War I, but like dropping in the paratroopers and.
Yeah, because my dad started out in the Army and then they formed the Air Force. So then he, because that didn't even exist before.
Yeah. And it's amazing. It's such an incredible event. Yeah. So that's an amazing trip. And we took my dad, who's very interested in everything history, and took him to all kinds of museums and things. So yeah, that was.
Yeah.
Everybody should go to Normandy at least for a couple of days. Every American in France anyway.
And
or Canadian.
I love the like Toulouse area where I learned about the pastel, which in the British code, the dye that was before indigo. I thought that was all very interesting too. I love that area.
Yeah.
And
in a couple of weeks, we're going to go spend a week out in Bergerac in Southwest France. You know, one of my other little projects that I have is there's an official organization in France called the Most Beautiful Villages in France. And they put out a book every year. There's about 165 villages that qualify to be deemed the most beautiful villages in France. So one of my goals is to go to each and every one of those villages throughout France. And I've been to about 65 of them so far out of the 165. But the biggest kind of conglomeration of them is in Southwest France near Bergerac. So we're going to go there for a week and I'm just going to spend a whole week going around and visiting as many villages as I can.
And he remembers each village and details about them all. After a while, they just all glom together in my brain.
Yeah, I feel like some of the smaller villages morph into one. I remember like certain places that we've been, but we did a big trip in the south of France and northern Italy in 2020 when we couldn't travel abroad from COVID. Wow. And yeah, some of those villages that we visited, I'm like, I think we went to that one, but
yeah, he questions me, do you know where you bought this? And I'm like, no.
I'll have to check out that book though. That sounds like a great travel itinerary.
Yeah, it's just called The Most Beautiful Villages in France, you know, and it's funny because some of the villages I go to, and as soon as you get there, you're like, oh yeah, absolutely. This is one of the most beautiful villages I've seen. And then other ones I get to and I'm like, I don't know about this one. How did this one get in? You know, I think there must be a lot of politics involved in
yeah.
it. Because
the mayor is the cousin of the editor.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, a lot of that stuff, if you have to apply, like our town is the Ville Fleurie, like the most flower, the cities with the most flowers. And honestly, you know, we do have quite a few flower beds around, but we're a pretty urban apartment building kind of town. And I don't know, like, yeah, have like a big, I'm in a town outside of Paris. I'm about 15 minutes from Paris. So yeah, there's flower pots on the barriers on the side of the départementale, but sorry, I'm not sure that outweighs the noise and pollution of the big busy street. So
well, at least I hear they're going to put noise radar in some towns around France.
Oh, we have a temporary radar right now that's just right under our building, so that helps a little bit. I'm not concerned so much that we're pretty well isolated from the noise, but it's more the pollution that.
And for us, the motorcycles, they love.
Oh, yeah. Out here. Yeah, that's one of the things that I just really don't like, especially on the highway. I think I don't know who would ever drive a motorcycle personally.
They're crazy. They drive. I'm amazed that we don't see more accidents because they're always just zooming in and out and in and out. I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, but.
I'm sure they're fun, but I don't know why they have to be so noisy.
Yeah, because otherwise, how would you notice them?
Maybe.
Yeah, we actually, unfortunately, saw an accident like a week or maybe 10 days ago. We were taking the bus to the pool and the bus pulled up and all of a sudden this intersection was completely blocked off. And it was a guy, it had just happened. The guy on a motorcycle had clipped in front of one of those white vans.
Yeah.
So the two vehicle types that cause the most accidents. Somebody else was a podcast guest commented that she hates the white vans because they're all unmarked and they all drive crazy.
Yeah.
And our dog doesn't like them.
Oh yeah.
don't know why, but she doesn't like the white bands.
Yeah, but the guy was on the ground and we watched the pompier kind of scrape him up and put him on the, he was alive and he was wearing a helmet, so that was good, but he did not.
Didn't look good, huh?
He didn't look, I didn't get close enough to really look, but we could hear him a bit and I just felt so awful for the guy. Yeah. But hopefully they didn't rush, so I'm hoping that means that they had time to get him to the hospital.
Yeah.
French because they don't rush.
Well, yeah, but I think in emergency situations they they can rally.
Oh, good. That's good to know. Actually, that's one of the things, of course, about France is the healthcare system. You know, mm-hmm. for us, that it's so inexpensive compared to the U.S. Although because of my language barrier, that makes me a little nervous. But I mm-hmm. do know other people that don't know French very well, and they've survived some severe health situations.
Yeah.
Knowing the language well. So that gives me.
Yeah. And it is possible sometimes to find English speaking doctors or doctors who claim to speak at least a little bit of English.
I did have a situation may vary. Early on where I had a scratched cornea. And I went to a doctor that one of our French friends recommended, and they said he spoke English. Well, it was iffy. So he said that I had corneal disease. And I was like, oh, crap, corneal disease, that's not good. Well, he just really meant I had an injured cornea. I had a scratched cornea, and that's a whole thing. So, yeah, the language can be rather important in your health issues.
Yeah, communicating the severity and the nuance of the condition. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had one client for a couple of years ago, and she was looking up we were looking up doctors for her on DoctoLib, the site where you can search by language. And yeah, there were definitely, like, we picked out one for her that looked good and it was in her neighborhood, and she went there. She was like, yeah, that person does not.
Yeah.
Actually speak English. But there are so many tools now, even using Google Translate and being able to use it with your phone and things like that make communication so much easier. Even if
I do that, I always print it out from, I always do it in English and then my Google Translate version, and I give them, you know, the letter or the note or whatever, just to make sure that when we're talking.
Yeah. Yeah. Back in the olden days, when I first got here, I used to do homework before I would go to any of these things. Like, I would write down my vocabulary list. Google Translate did exist, but it wasn't on your phone. I didn't have an iPhone.
Yeah.
So, I would make my vocabulary list and try to be very sure about what I was going to say. And then I would get there and I would say the thing perfectly. And then somebody would respond to me and I would be like, oh, I didn't learn those words.
Or sometimes the accent's so heavy that I still can't understand. And then I had hearing loss, I got hearing aids, which I wanted ones that would translate French, but he said they didn't exist yet. But
I'm sure that's coming.
I know.
No, yeah, the doctor said that's at some point they'll be there because her hearing aids are, you know, synced up with her iPhone, so she can adjust the volume and adjust things and do stuff.
Answer the phone by tapping my ear twice. But I know, pretty cool.
But he said, you know, eventually they're going to get to the point where you could click a button and say, whatever is coming in, if it's coming in French, just translate it to English and send it to me in English. And at some point they'll be able to do that.
But my point was that before I got the hearing aids, it was like, okay, I have hearing loss. They've got a heavy accent. We've got masks on. I can't see their lips. And
there's plexiglass between you.
Yeah.
It was like, really? And I'm supposed to be able to understand this?
Yeah. That was, I sometimes have trouble if there's a lot of background noise. I have trouble like filtering. Mm-hmm. Masks. Plus all the plexiglass, you don't realize how much you rely on just context and those other.
Well, they say that we rely a lot on lip reading more than we're aware of. It's not.
Oh, yeah. Well, we became very aware of it, I think. I became very aware of it.
Yeah.
And when I started my French lessons, we were wearing masks for French lessons. Yeah. It was like.
Yeah, and you really need to know the mouth muscles move very differently in French. You really have to train your mouth and work those muscles in order to be able to pronounce correctly.
Yeah.
Many challenges. Yeah. It's not all the romantic adventure. There are many challenges.
Yeah.
But, and the other thing is that when I tell people that I had to move to the south of France, nobody will give me any sympathy.
Oh, I know. Such a hard life.
It is. It's really hard.
Yeah, but I will, a couple of things else I wanted to say. It is funny with a lot of Americans, not necessarily our real friends, but just people, acquaintances in America, you know, we'll hear from them from time to time and they're like, so how's life in Paris? And I'm like, no, we're not in Paris. You know, it's like so many Americans, it's like, that's all there is in France, is just Paris. They assume if you move to France, you must be living in Paris. And I'm like, no, we don't live in Paris. Oh, yeah. Really? Oh, okay. So it's funny with Americans like that, you know. But, and you had asked about funny or embarrassing little story. So I have one of those if you'd like to hear it.
Please, so yes.
We were, right after we moved here, we had gone to out to eat dinner with a friend of ours, a French friend of ours, to a nice little Middle Eastern restaurant. And I'm a vegetarian. So when we got there, you know, it was fine. There was plenty of stuff for me to eat. But the waitress, being a vegetarian now is much easier than it was 30 years ago in France. 30 years ago, it was almost impossible to find food to eat. Now it's much better. But, you know, the waitress was asking what we wanted. And I said, well, I'm vegetarian. I don't eat meat. I don't eat fish. I don't eat chicken. And she's like, okay. You know, people are still a little sometimes, they don't quite understand it, but they're a little more accepting about it. So, you know, we had dinner and,
I forgot the wine.
Yeah. And so then she asked, you know, what do you want to drink? Would you like some wine? We have some great wine. I was like, no, I don't really drink wine. And she was like, oh, okay. You know, that's a little harder for French people to wrap their heads around sometimes that you don't drink wine, you know. So, no, I don't drink wine. So then we finished dinner and she's like, would you like some coffee? I don't drink coffee. So I'm like, well, I don't drink coffee. And she's looking at me and she finally says to me, she says, well, do you have any vices at all? And I like sweets as well. So what I meant to say was, j'adore pâtisseries. You know, I love pâtisseries, sweets. But what she heard was, j'adore petites souris, that I love little mice. And she was just like, what?
He was looking at him so strangely. And finally, after a minute or two, our French friend figured out what the problem was.
She was like, oh, you don't eat meat, but you like to eat little mice? And I'm like, no, not little mice. Patisseries. You know, I kept trying, but it just wasn't coming out right. But she mistook patisseries for pâtisseries, little mice. So it was pretty funny.
I'm sure she went home to tell her friends about the strange American customer who...
Yes.
Wanted mice for dessert.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Even 10 years ago, vegetarianism was not really easy. Even in Paris, when I first came here, I had a college friend who came to visit when I was studying abroad. And we went out to some restaurant and they brought the rest of our meals and they completely forgot about her because she had ordered like they had an assiette végétarienne on the menu. They completely forgot about her, didn't bring it. And so then she asked, and by that time it was like 9:30, 10 o'clock, and the place was kind of starting to empty out, and they brought her a plate. It had literally white rice and lettuce and a sliced up tomato, and that was her dinner that they tried to charge her like 15 euros for.
Yeah. Yep. I had a similar experience probably 20 years ago. I was up in the mountains in the Alps cycling with a friend of mine, and we were both vegetarian in a very small town. And they didn't know what to make of it. They're like, And so they went back into the kitchen and like a half hour later came out with a plate that had half an onion, had an onion sliced in half. It had half an onion and a beet sliced in half. And it had an onion and a beet that had been baked. And that was it. And I'm like, okay, I like onions and beets are okay, but I wouldn't eat just half an onion and half a beet as my main course for dinner here, you know? So, because, you know, it's like there's pasta, there's, you know, egg, you know, it's just, but it is a lot better now than it was then. Yeah. You know, we had another funny experience one time actually in Paris, probably about more than 20 years ago. You know, there's an American restaurant chain called TGIF. Thank God it's Friday. And there was one, I don't know if there still is or not in Paris, but there was one in Paris in the 90s. And so we were there at Thanksgiving time, American Thanksgiving time. And our French friend that we were staying with said, hey, you know, we can go to TGIF because they have an American base. They're going to have an American Thanksgiving on Thanksgiving. We're like, great, okay, you know, go down there, have American Thanksgiving. So we got down there and they had a special menu, you know, American food and turkey and all that kind of stuff. Everyone, all the waiters and the staff, they were all dressed up for Thanksgiving. And they were all dressed up as Indians and cowboys.
Not Indians and pilgrims, but Indians and cowboys.
And we were like, well, we got pretty close there. Not quite right, you know, because they were all these Western gun tooting, you know, stuff. It's like, no, it's not Indians and cowboys. It's Indians and pilgrims. But, you know, nice try.
A couple hundred years off, but, you know.
But it was pretty funny. And at least they were trying, you know.
Yeah.
Well, what was funny to me is they still, in the U.S., you can't do that anymore. You shouldn't do that anymore.
Right.
And, but I mean, here people don't, you know, it's not a thing at all that would bother anybody.
Right. Yeah, right.
And there aren't really indigenous peoples in Europe that are still around.
Yeah.
So we went to, there's a theme park that's probably about an hour from us. And it's like a desert themed park and they have cowboy and Indian shows. In 2021, we saw this kind of show when I was watching it. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like, but it's not sensitive here.
Sure. Yeah.
And you can't, it's very difficult to make people understand that actually that's not okay.
Right.
And I don't know what tribe they were supposed to be representing. It's generally just a Native American person,
right.
And they pull in symbolism that probably doesn't go together. And
yeah.
Anyway, so what are you looking forward to for the next couple of years? What plans do you have for, I don't know, enjoying France?
Well, talking about Thanksgiving, actually, Steve decided the first year that we would do an American Thanksgiving for our friends, our foreign friends. And so that was a lot of fun because we're not entertainers. We have never in the 25 years we've been together entertained at all. But we managed to pull off a Thanksgiving dinner, not completely Americanized, but it was a lot of fun, even though we discovered that we cook so much that we didn't discover until that night that the oven didn't work at all. And but we got chickens from the market and we had a great time with a dozen friends.
Wow.
But now,
yeah,
now we have so many more friends that we were trying to do two last year. And this year we're going to have to do three.
Yeah, we're having like 12 people over on Thursday, another 12 on Friday, another 12 on Saturday and stuff, you know. But it's kind of fun, you know, establishing this little tradition here. Our French friends love it because, as you know, Thanksgiving means nothing to the French people. So they think it's fun and learn about American traditions and stuff. But
a British friend though, the funniest thing she thought was when I brought out the fruit salad, you know, American fruit salad and it's whipped cream and all the fruit and, well, usually marshmallows, but I didn't put marshmallows in it. But I brought that out with the rest of the food. And she was like, wait, you eat dessert with your meal? And I said, yeah, this is a part of the meal. And she still talks about that as being so weird.
But that's the only dessert thing that you eat with the meal. Yeah, we always had that too. Like,
yeah.
You mean Oh, maybe I should make that this year. I haven't made that before. I've always hosted a Thanksgiving dinner too.
Yeah.
I've always done it the Saturday after Thanksgiving. We invite all of our French friends.
Yeah.
We have to make up for all these people that invite us over for dinner and apparels. And since we don't entertain, this is our payback.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you're right that it's fun and they like to see. Because I remember one guy worked with my husband years ago, and he came to Thanksgiving one year, and his comment was like, oh, I didn't really know Americans could cook like this. Like they, you know, his conception of what Americans eat was just kind of, you know, McDonald's.
Yeah.
And it's true that we don't necessarily have a national cuisine. We have a couple of things that I think the French tend to associate with fast food. It's really fun when people come over for dinner and they're like, oh, actually American cooking is kind of good.
And then trying to make pumpkin pie. I had to order from Amazon the pumpkin.
Mm.
And then they don't really have pie plates or pie crust. They have the tart. So you kind of have to, you know, compromise on and improvise on some things.
Yeah, I have to be honest. I roast, I buy like the big slices of pumpkin and I roast it and I mash it down into puree and then I drain it over the sink because it's too wet.
Yeah.
So yeah, I do a whole thing. I spend a good week.
Well, we don't do that.
Getting ready for Thanksgiving.
She likes the canned pumpkin.
Well, you can order that now from My American Market or there's a couple of different ones.
Get my Dr. Pepper.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the Dr. Pepper here, it took me quite a while to figure out why it tasted so bad to me. And it was because they use artificial sweetener in their regular Dr. Pepper, which is odd. You know, I understand it in the diet, but not the regular. So I was an addict until I moved here. I've had to give up is my Dr. Pepper addiction.
We all make sacrifices.
Yeah,
I know.
But you know, you're asking, as far as the future goes, we're just getting more and more settled in. And like I said, I love exploring France. So we plan trips to go places and do things. I want to see all the different parts of France. And I continue to write about stuff for our website. You know, I write, on average, maybe one article a week. I just did this summer, I did an 8-day backpacking trip through the Mercantour National Park, which is a big national park down here with a friend of mine. So I've started writing about that. And Carol's trying to get me to go on some little trips and vacations to some of the neighboring countries, but I'm still resisting that at this point. It's like, I'm not through with France yet. You know, once I've seen all of France, then yeah, sure, we can go to Italy or Switzerland, but I'm not done with France yet. You know.
And I hope to make more trips. For years, Steve came over here for several months out of the year. That was my plan to do in reverse, to be able to go back to the US and see family and friends. Well, then COVID hit. So that threw a monkey wrench into all of that. So I'm hoping to get back to that, even though right now still traveling is a major hassle, but I'm hoping that'll get better.
Yeah. Yeah. So what do you miss the most about the US? Is there anything that...
I think, well, the ease because of the language, of course, is a big thing. And also I can't drive here anymore. It's been over a year. And since I don't know the language, I wouldn't be able to pass the test. But it's not a really big issue because of where we live, that I can walk to, you know, 5 grocery stores and, you know, pretty much everything. But it is nice to be able to go back there and drive and know where I'm going and be able to understand the signs and know where to get this or that, you know, at what store. But mostly friends, visiting friends. And then Mexican food.
That comes up a lot.
That's the one thing that I really miss about the U.S. We lived in Texas for 20 years before we ended up in Nashville. So we're used to a lot of really good Tex-Mex food. And, you know, there's 3 Mexican restaurants in Nice, and we've been to them all, and they're okay, but they're nowhere near, you know, what good Mexican food is like in the U.S.
Although we have discovered Barcelonette. Do you know about Barcelonette?
No.
It has the largest immigration from France to Mexico between 1850 and 1950. And some of them, a lot of them were successful there in the textile business. And then they went on to, I don't know, open department stores and go into politics. But some of them came back with their wealth and they built some big Mexican villa kind of things in Barcelonette. There's shops and Mexican shops there. And I think there's Mexican restaurants. So we want to go back and eat there.
It's about 2 hours from us where we are here. And, you know, they have a big Mexican festival during the summer. They have a big Day of the Dead festival in October. There's just a real strong Mexican culture there. And they have a really good authentic Mexican store where they import a lot of goods. So when we were there, we bought canned refried beans and a whole bunch of stuff that we have a hard time finding up here.
Yeah. Well, if they have an online store, I bet I know a lot of people who would be interested.
I don't think they do have an online store.
Yeah.
Just a little
shy. Well, still a good place to know about.
Yeah, absolutely.
I sadly was cursed with the cilantro taste like soap gene. Genetic defect. So
I know people like cilantro. Yeah.
So I like Mexican food, but it's not my favorite. Nice. I wish I could have more, but because I don't like the cilantro, there are too many dishes that I probably wouldn't try or like.
Huh.
Yeah.
I don't know if many of the dishes I eat have cilantro in them. don't know.
Well, even like something like guacamole. Like I make guacamole all the time, but I never put cilantro in it. Yeah, and when you get it at a restaurant, like normally it has, but.
I'm hearing it, it's going off.
Great. Well, I guess last question. Do you have any advice for somebody who might be thinking about moving to France?
Don't move in August. Do learn some of the language before you move here.
I think my basic advice is just do your homework before you come, which is really important. You know, I'd been coming over here, you know, for so many years and staying in Vence that I really knew this town inside and out before we moved here. So it was fairly easy for us to move in, you know, but it really is important to kind of do your homework ahead of time. And then also it's people say it all the time, but you know, you have to make an effort to fit in and to integrate into the French society. If you don't, you're never really going to have a real home here, I don't think, you know, but the French people are just so supportive and friendly and welcoming if they see you making an attempt to integrate into their culture and their society. That's just a really important aspect of it all.
And then, of course, they know that Steve just loves them, so.
Yeah, it's really easy to make friends when you flatter, you know, what, and I don't even mean flatter and like you're not being, you know, you're not exaggerating in an untrue way, but you know, the more appreciative you are or can be about French language, French culture, anything, it really goes a long way.
And we just met so many really nice and helpful people when we first moved and needed a lot of help. Just when we were trying to furnish our place, because we came with no furniture at all. We came with 16 boxes of a lifetime of belongings for the two of us. And we, on Le Bon Coin or on Facebook Marketplace, we went shopping. And like there was, in the next town over, we found a dining room set. And we were talking, trying to figure out how are we gonna get this in our car? How are we gonna get this up 4 flights of stairs? We don't have an elevator. And they, I guess, understood enough English that they offered to deliver it to us. They carried this heavy glass thing all the way up 4 flights of stairs, would not let us help. It was like, how nice.
Wow, yeah, that's great.
Yeah, the one other thing I would tell people, like we came from Tennessee, which is, you know, she was talking about driver's licenses, not have a reciprocal agreement for driver's licenses. And so I ended up having to take the French tests and stuff, which was challenge.
But you wanted to, because you wanted to be French.
But I was able to do it and I passed and got my French license. But if you come from a state that does not have a reciprocal license, figure out a way to get a license from a state that does, you know.
No, but legally.
Yeah, legally. But
yeah, you know, yeah, yeah.
It's very easy to do if you have a friend that lives in, you know, some state that does, and you can get some mail sent to their address and you can get an address established and then you can apply for a driver's license there, then it's so much easier to be able to exchange your license than to go through the whole system of taking the tests.
On the other hand, you don't learn the laws and you don't, you
know, true.
That's kind of interesting that, you know, this whole group of people has to learn everything about driving here and this group of people doesn't have to learn anything.
Yeah. And then you learn all the laws and then you look out in the road and you see that nobody actually follows any of the laws.
Oh, there's that too. Yes, there's that too.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Sure. It's our pleasure.
Have a great rest of your day.
You too.
And take care.
All right. We'll talk to you again sometime.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Profiles in Transformation with Allison Grant Luness. If you liked this episode, please like, subscribe, and share on social media. I'll see you next time for a new episode, and in the meantime, I hope we've inspired you today to pursue your dreams, no matter how big or small. Remember, the way you bring your own dreams into reality is by believing in yourself and taking small steps towards your goal. Start today, start now, and à bientôt.